Side Hustle Show 263, three Amazon FBA private label product research strategies for 2018 and beyond. What's up? Nick Loper here. Welcome to the Side Hustle Show, because every expert was once a beginner. Man, where did this year go? I don't understand how we're already at the end of December. It was just a blur. But in any case, I've got an awesome show for you today, actually bringing back one of my most popular guests to talk about getting started with one of the most popular side hustles. Of course, I'm talking about Mr. Greg Mercer, who we last heard from a couple years ago on episode 158. Now, the side hustle in question is Amazon FBA, Fulfillment by Amazon, where you find a product you think will sell and has good profit margins, you send it into the warehouse, and Amazon picks, packs, and ships it for you when somebody buys it. It's a way for individual sellers and side hustlers to essentially tap into the world's largest audience of buyers and a world-class logistics network. Very cool stuff. Now, Greg is the go-to guy for FBA stuff in general, and specifically for private label product research. This is where you launch your own brand based on what's already selling. Greg has done this over 100 times on Amazon, including a few public examples like the bamboo marshmallow sticks, jungle sticks, and hooded baby towels. Just those two products combined are earning $12,000 a month in profit, and Greg's doing some cool partnerships with Doctors Without Borders and Pencils of Promise with that income. But how do you know what to sell? That's what this episode is about. Greg is going to walk us through his three favorite product research strategies for 2018 and beyond. You're going to learn the exact criteria he looks for in terms of competitiveness, sales, profit margin, and manufacturing. This is really good stuff, but if you're driving, you're at the gym, you're out walking the dog, don't worry, I took notes for you. You can download the free PDF highlight reel with all of Greg's top tips from this call at sidehustlenation.com/Greg. I'm going to be back with my top takeaways from this chat with Greg after the interview. Ready? Let's do it.
As far as other big changes, there are more Amazon sellers like kind of in the marketplace. There are more people doing the private label thing. But at the same time, the marketplace itself is growing so fast and there's so many consumers on there too, that I wouldn't even necessarily say that it's more competitive. I think I can launch products just as successfully today as I did 2 or 3 years ago. But maybe now we're looking for even like more obscure items than before. It's maybe not as much the very hot or trendy type items, but instead these very niche and obscure items.
All right, well, let's dive into some examples of those. When, let's say I'm starting out, I'm looking for my first product. Like, what are some of the must-haves? What boxes does this have to check for you?
We want to find opportunities on Amazon that have existing demand on Amazon. So that means people are already going there, searching for that product and buying it. We're not trying to guess what we think these people might like or might be buying. So that's the most important thing. We want something that's low competition, because of course, there's lots of items that sell really well on Amazon, but a lot of them are very competitive. So we want high demand with low competition.
So you're gauging demand based on sales rank, or say like, hey, instead of like trying to invent a brand new product from scratch, like that's maybe new and novel in your head, but kind of unproven, untested in the market. You say, look, I want to go with something that's tried and true that I know people are already buying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's one of like the biggest pitfalls that people fall into. Actually, they'll tell me like, hey, Greg, I was looking for this product on Amazon. I couldn't find it. So I'm sure if I were to launch that product on Amazon, it would do really well, because I bet there's other people like me looking for it on Amazon. It's like, well, maybe there's a small chance that that's correct, but what's more likely is that there's actually just very little demand for that product on Amazon. That's why no one's selling it. So it's much less risky to instead just kind of go off the numbers and just sell what people are already searching for and already buying on Amazon.
Okay. And then what are you using to determine kind of like the low competition metric? So the sales rank will give us an estimate of how often this thing is selling or how many units they're selling. And you can, of course, do that inside of the Jungle Scout tool too. But what's your gauge of low competition?
The two best ways to gauge the competition is, one, the number of reviews. Products that have a lower number of reviews are going to be less competitive to compete against for two reasons. One, it's because they have less social proof, so it's easier to kind of like catch up with them and earn like just as many or more reviews than what they have. And two, the other reason that's a good indicator is that if this product is selling well, even though it has a very low number of reviews, that signifies to us that this product hasn't been around on Amazon very long, yet is already doing very well. So that's another good indicator of demand. So I look for the number of reviews and I look for the overall listing quality. some listings on Amazon, I'm sure a lot of people have seen them, are of very high quality. They have 8 images. The images are very nice and high quality. They have lifestyle images of people, you know, happily using this product or whatever else. They may have a competitive matrix on their products. Some of these other types of things signify a very high quality listing. And then you go to other listings and there's like one picture and it's like a terrible picture, right? And there's only 3 bullet points and each bullet point's only like 5 words. So we know they're not being indexed for very many keywords. That's the other indicator of something of like high competition or low competition, depending on the quality of that listing.
Okay. We'll dive into kind of how you're maybe going about getting those or, you know, playing catch up in the number of reviews. What else on the kind of high level product criteria comes to mind?
I like higher priced products. So when I say higher price, I'm just talking about like $18 or more. Though very low priced products like $7, $9, $12, a lot of Amazon's fulfillment fees are like flat fees, like the pick and pack fees, like a flat, like $3. So if you're selling a product for like $8, $9, including these flat fees, even if you have decent margins, you're probably only making like $1 or $2 per sale. And it just takes a lot of sales if you're only making $1 or $2 profit to add up to a substantial amount of money. So I prefer a little bit higher priced items, like $18 or more.
Okay. And so that's going to kind of increase your initial investment, but hopefully you make it back on the back end and it kind of reduces, hopefully, the number of people who are also kind of playing in that same arena.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah, there's a few other things. There's just like little boxes to check. One would be, I want to make sure that product's not like patented. Of course, you know, you don't want to rip off someone's product if they have a patent on it, because that'd be illegal.
Would the current Amazon listing say like, hey, this is patented or patent pending? Or like, how would you check for that?
A lot of people are proud of their patent, so they'd put it right in their Amazon listing or right on their website. It's also often stamped on the product, like patent pending or patent number, blah, blah, blah. And then the other thing you could do, the easiest way is actually just to Google it. So if I'm checking to see if this widget is patented, I would just search like widget patent on Google. And oftentimes the patent information will pull up right there. If you still want to take it one step further, you can go to the name slipping me, but it's the US government agency that handles patents.
Okay.
And they have a search function on their website to search for it.
Okay. I think it's like USPTO.gov or something.
Yeah, exactly. I always forget the acronym there, but
I'm probably messing up the order of the letters too.
Hey, it's close enough. That works. And then the last couple of things, I prefer a product to have low seasonality. So all products are going to have some sort of seasonality, but I don't like to sell like Christmas trees or something else that only sells for like 1 month out of the year. And then a couple other small things are, I would like to improve on the product if possible, and I prefer the product to be kind of smaller or lighter weight.
Okay, this is an important note to make is like, okay, so we're not just trying to find something and then copy it exactly. We're just trying to make some product improvement to it, trying to make it better, that's ultimately, hopefully, what this is all about. It's like not just importing more crap from China, but like, hey, we're trying to make a better shopping experience for people. We're trying to like improve the world a little bit rather than just like playing a Me Too game.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I guess we didn't really clarify at the beginning, but all these tips are guidelines that I'm giving you. These would all refer to selling a private label product. Of course, there's other ways to source and sell products on Amazon, but that would be what I'm referring to when I give you this outline.
Okay, cool. And are you looking at the existing reviews for these things to say like what could be improved upon, or just like, would you order it yourself and be like, well, I found that this was crappy, or how do you kind of go about doing the improvements?
Yeah, so the reviews is the best way to do it. And what's so cool to me is kind of like how, you know, the internet just changes everything. But even just like 10 years ago, these big companies, they were probably paying tens of thousands of dollars to do these research groups or whatever, right? To find ways to improve upon their product. Now, just like me or you in 5 minutes with zero investment could go read the negative reviews on Amazon and find out ways that we can improve upon these products. So that's exactly what I do. I just go read all the 3-, 2-, 1-star reviews. I see what people are complaining about. And oftentimes it's really easy things to improve upon. For example, people might just be leaving a bad review because they're saying that it arrived at their house damaged. Well, that's not even necessarily an improvement on the product itself, but it probably just needs some better packaging to be able to withstand, you know, the shipment process. So oftentimes it's just like small, simple things like that where we're not inventing new products, but we're making small improvements on products that really increase the overall quality and user experience.
Okay. And one of the things that I bought recently was like a new monitor connector cable. And the reviews were like, oh, the metal piece at the end is too heavy. So it like falls out, like the connector thing like falls out. And so I was like, well, crap, I don't want that one. So I went to the other one and it was like, hey, you know, it's a lightweight thing. I was like, okay. So maybe somebody did exactly that. I don't know if you're messing around with like electronics products or anything, but it seemed like maybe somebody kind of went through that same process.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They probably did.
Well, let's dive into these three strategies for the research, or kind of the three high-level strategies. So the first one that I have down is big demand, but bad reviews. The second one is big demand, big sales, but poor marketing, poor listings on Amazon. And the third one is kind of immature listings that seem to be selling well. These are high demand products, but you know, maybe there's not very many of them. Maybe there's not very many reviews left. So jump into the first one. This is big demand and bad reviews. Tell me about that strategy.
Yeah, so this is my favorite one, and this is what I use now for when I launch most of my products. We started to speak to this a little bit earlier, but what we're looking for here are products that are selling very well on Amazon, even though they have these crappy reviews, right? And the idea here, and it's very successfully, I've proven this a whole bunch of times, is if people are willing to purchase this product on Amazon and purchase a lot of them, even though it has pretty poor reviews, then that shows that like this is an item that people really want. They just can't really find anything better to purchase or better to purchase at that price point.
Yeah.
So this is like my favorite strategy to use on Amazon right now. I'm finding these products that are selling like 1,000 units a month, even though they have like 3 stars or 3.5 star reviews. I find out usually relatively simple things to improve upon. And then if I essentially launch a very similar product, but it's getting like 4.5 star reviews because I've made some improvements, then I will capture a lot of the sales from my competitors because now these people want this improved product instead of this other one of lesser quality.
Right, right. And what's kind of cool is you can often filter by star rating in little sidebar filters to say, okay, these are the ones that aren't doing so well, which is really surprising. It's like when I kind of come up a listing that's like 3 stars, it's like, I don't know. And then you kind of read them and you're like, ooh, people, you know, this could go either way. I don't know if I want to buy this. And so that makes total sense. It's like, if you can kind of come into the market, make some product improvements to make it better, that seems like a good way to go. Now, is there a metric on both of those that you want to see, like a minimum number of sales and then a minimum, or maybe like I should say maximum star rating that would qualify for this?
I used to give the answer like, it depends too much. Like listeners of podcasts, they don't want to hear it depends, right? So let me give you some rules of thumb instead.
Okay. We love it.
So the demand I'm looking for is throughout the entire niche as opposed to one individual product. So if I search for marshmallow sticks right now, even if there's one listing that's selling a lot, but everyone else is selling very few, that's not really a niche I want to go into because I don't really know why that one person's selling a lot. Maybe he's driving outside traffic to his listing or something. So instead, I want to look for demand throughout an entire niche. So I want to search for marshmallow sticks and see like 5 sellers selling 500 units or the total demand throughout the niche. So I would like to see like at least 2,000 units of demand throughout the entire niche.
That's per month?
Per month, that's correct. So like 2,000 units per month are already being sold on Amazon for marshmallow sticks or whatever my item is.
This edition of The Side Hustle Show is sponsored by Squarespace. You probably already know that Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, but it turns out Squarespace is a lot more than just a pretty website builder. For example, did you know that Squarespace has a new AI-guided design system called Squarespace Blueprint? I was playing around with this the other day. It's pretty slick and might be the fastest way to get a professionally curated layout tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Did you know that Squarespace can also host your online course? You can create the lessons that your audience is going to love, then you add your paywall and set the price. You can charge a one-time fee, you can sell subscriptions, and you can customize the whole thing to fit your brand. And finally, flexible payment options. Whether you're selling a course or a digital product or a physical product or your own services, Squarespace makes checkout seamless for your customers by letting you accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay. And in eligible countries, you can even offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So head on over to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/sidehustle to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
When you're hiring, it feels amazing to finally close out a job search and hit the ground running with your new hire. But what if you could get rid of the search part and just get matched with qualified candidates? Well, now you can with our sponsor, Indeed. It's simple. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. The matching and hiring platform is trusted by over 3.5 million businesses worldwide to connect with great talent faster. And 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. For my next hire, I'm using Indeed to tap into a talent pool of 350 million unique monthly visitors. And what else is cool is Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use it, the better it gets. And how about this? Side Hustle Show listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Side Hustle Show. Just go to Indeed.com/Side Hustle Show right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Side Hustle Show. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And so you can estimate that through Jungle Scout, the software, or you can estimate that at junglescout.com/estimator. I'm curious, have you seen a bunch of competitors come into the marshmallow stick niche after your case study?
Oh, yeah, of course. And same thing with the hooded baby towels. It's like, guys, I'm teaching you every single step of how to like replicate this, but I wasn't intending for you to do the exact same product. Like, I'm giving you the numbers so you can come up with your own product.
Yeah. But they're still selling even despite the extra competition.
Yeah, it's fine. The marshmallow sticks, they're doing like incredible. Some months are selling over 1,000 units, or I think like October was our best month and it sold like a few thousand units. The baby towels, when we launched that one, we probably had like, it was a lot, probably like 20 or 30 people like entered the exact same time as us. And it was pretty clear, like it was just exact copycats like from our case study. But yeah, that one's still doing fine too. It sells like 500 units a month though, not 1,000 or more like the marshmallow sticks.
I wonder if the factory is just like, oh man, these things are just blowing up right now. Like, what is going on?
Yeah, they probably were like, man, this is like the hottest product of the season.
I guess so. Okay. So it was a minimum of 2,000 units per month being sold across the whole niche, not just the one listing. And then on the review side, look, I want to see just less than 4 stars. Like, what's the metric there?
I think a rule of thumb would be 3.5 stars. Okay. If it's selling really well and has 3.5 stars or less, then that's a great indicator that it's a product that should be easy to improve upon.
Okay. Are there any general categories that you like for people to get started with? In retail arbitrage, I understand there's a lot of categories that are now gated to new sellers, and there's some hoops you got to jump through to kind of get permission to sell into those. For private label, is it just a free-for-all? Is it fair game?
There's gated categories in private label as well. So that would be like health and beauty, jewelry, watches, grocery. I think a couple other ones I didn't name.
Okay.
I would probably recommend staying away from those because you can get ungated, but it's just like one more step or one more hassle. You know, you have to get together some paperwork, and especially when beginning, it's just so important to like keep good momentum, right? And not get bogged down by little things like having to get ungated. So I'd recommend to stay away from those categories. Besides that, I don't really have any other favorite categories. There's like good products in all of them. I typically stay away from electronics or like complex products. So that would say that, well, the electronics category and cell phone category and a few of those wouldn't be my favorite categories. But overall, I don't have any specific categories that I really favor.
What's interesting to me as an outside observer is you seem to be niche agnostic. You're not saying like, hey, I'm super into golf, so I'm going to enter the golf category. I'm super into dogs, so I'm going to make a pet product. It's like, hey, look, I'm going to go where the numbers guide me.
That's exactly right. And that's what I recommend everyone else to do too, because the numbers don't lie. If you can kind of like remove your emotion from it and remove what you think's a cool or sexy product and instead just go off which the numbers are telling you, like, hey, this product's in high demand with low competition. The margins are good. If you kind of like base your decisions off the numbers, I think a lot more people would see the success in their business.
Okay. Let's go into strategy number two. This is big sales, but poor marketing or poor listings on Amazon. What does that look like?
Yeah. So again, this would be big demand, kind of like the first strategy. But this one, maybe it doesn't get poor reviews. They just have a really bad listing. So if you find an item, it's selling 1,000 units a month, but they only have one or two pictures. Their title's only like 5 words long. They've only used 3 out of 5 bullet points. You get the idea here. Like overall, just a poor quality listing. And this is a good opportunity for sellers to sell a very similar product or even the same product, but market it very well. We've done a lot of tests about improving your conversion rates and all that type of stuff. The main thing is the pictures. Amazon allows you 8 pictures. You want to use all 8 of those. You want to have very high quality images, ideally some type of lifestyle photos or images of these being shown, or to help show the overall size or dimensions of your product. Those are good. And then other than that, it's important to have lots of keywords in your listing, specifically with the title, the bullet points, and then also in the description. So if you do all of those things, then you overall have a high quality listing. Whereas these competitors that we're talking about of kind of going after, they're typically not indexed for very many keywords because they don't have very many. They only have a couple images, which leads to poor conversion rates. So this, again, would be a great opportunity for sellers.
And do you have a resource that you like for taking those product pictures, that product photography?
There's a whole bunch of companies that do good product photography. The one in the US that I've been using lately is called, I think it's just called productphotography.com. Or maybe the Product Photography Studio. I forget exactly, but if you Google it, there's a whole bunch of good ones. I think on one of our blog posts too, again, if you probably Google this, you can find, we talk about kind of like a DIY to create high-end product images yourself, as well as we give a list of kind of like some other photographers that we've seen produce high-quality work.
Okay. So is it not seen as like super spammy to just stuff your title with a million keywords? I mean, as long as they're relevant?
No, I think it's fine. Yeah, as long as they're relevant. They allow like 150 characters, and I mean, it works. They definitely take those keywords in your title. They weight those the heaviest. So I would definitely encourage everyone to stuff their titles with all of the most relevant keywords.
Okay. And is it not a case of like, I'm going to dilute the strength of my primary keyword by including all these kind of secondary ones to max out my 150 characters?
No, I don't think their indexing is that sophisticated yet.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, like for Google SEO, it's like, well, I want to, you know, kind of front load that. And, you know, I don't know, I don't want to mess up all these other keywords at the end of it.
Right. The one thing about Amazon that Google doesn't quite have the benefit to do is, to a high degree of accuracy, they can also track conversions. So you could kind of argue this with Google, since you install Google Analytics tracking scripts on your site. But with Amazon, they know, you know, okay, this person searched for bamboo marshmallow sticks. They clicked on my listing and then they purchased it. So that tells Amazon that that is a very relevant keyword. It is working. But yeah, we do know that they weight the keywords in the title the heaviest.
Okay. And one cool thing inside of Jungle Scout, I don't know if this is new over the last couple of years, but your like listing competitiveness score, I thought that was kind of a cool, maybe a made up metric, but kind of a cool thing to see.
That's exactly what we do. We've kind of like determined all the factors that make a high quality listing or a listing that would probably convert really well. So then we grade them all on a scale of 1 through 10 or 1 through 100 of essentially how high quality that listing is or what the likelihood is that it will convert well.
All right. Tell me about strategy number 3. This is new markets, trending markets maybe, but with immature listings. I like that term. They're selling a lot, but they don't have any reviews yet.
Yeah. So this would just be like a great indicator to someone that this is a very up and coming or potentially like hot product. So this is a good strategy to use, and people still do use it. But I'd say of the 3 that we listed, this one's probably like a little bit more risky.
Okay.
Because it's a little bit unproven. So if we would have looked at like fidget spinners over the summer, this would be like a great example of this. There were listings that were brand new. They had like 1 review or no reviews, but they were selling like 5,000 units per month, or like this crazy amount.
Wow.
And if you got into it right then, and even if you only sold for a few months, you probably made a lot of money in a very short amount of time. But the downside of this one is it's kind of unproven. Now there's probably a bunch of people stuck with fidget spinners right now, because I don't think anyone buys these anymore. I don't know. Maybe this is like a high risk, high reward type strategy, but it is a way to discover up and coming or soon to be hot niches.
Yeah. So you could sort by, you know, whatever category you like and just look at the best sellers and see, okay, how many of these, what are the ones with like very few reviews, to see, okay, is this something that you could see having sustained demand, or is this kind of just a fad that's gonna go away? I could totally see how this would be riskier, because you, in the moment, it's hard to say, oh, is the fidget spinner a fad thing, or is it gonna be like everybody's gotta have this?
Yeah, exactly. So you kind of have to use a little gut instinct there, which I don't like to do. I like to go off the numbers, but you can be kind of thinking about that. It's like fidget spinners. Okay, we could probably have guessed that was a fad, but there are other new tech type products that are probably going to stand the test of time a little bit better. They're just pretty new and young at the time.
What do you think about the strategy? So we talked with Andy Slammons about a year ago, and he was giving some examples of creating bundles, creating like packages of products. I think one that he gave was like the man's barbecue Christmas set. Okay, the silicone barbecue gloves are out of control competitive, but if we bundle them with this, this, and this, like now it's this cool gift set and it's got great margins. Are you doing any of that to differentiate listings?
Yes and no. I do that a little bit. The downside of this is it is kind of like an extra hurdle that sometimes stops people from launching products or getting started. But a good example of this is actually the baby towels that I launched publicly. What I did here was most of my competitors were just selling the hooded baby towels, and I bundled my hooded baby towel with a washcloth. And the washcloth was actually just waste fabric from the factory. They get their rolls of fabric in a certain width. My baby towel wasn't that wide, so there was like 12 inches that were going to be cut off and disposed of.
Okay.
And instead of disposing them, they made those into washcloths. So it only cost me, I think, like 25 cents to add that washcloth to my baby towel and therefore make a bundle.
Okay.
Yet it was like a little bit of a differentiating factor, because it's like, okay, if someone else launches and it's the same baby towel, but it doesn't have this like nice high quality washcloth with it, which one would you rather buy? Well, hopefully most of the time people are going to pick the one with the washcloth. So I do a little bit of bundling like that.
Okay.
I tend to stay away from bundling two very different products that wouldn't be made in the same factory, because I have found it's quite a bit of a hassle trying to coordinate with these two factories, and then production time for one gets delayed and then they can't ship it out for a few more weeks or whatever else. So that is a viable strategy. But if someone's listening to this right now and you're trying to get your first product launched, I would probably stay away from that one, at least for your first product, until you kind of figure it out.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so we've gone through these three strategies and maybe we found a handful of potential products that look like they could be winners. That look like maybe there's something we can improve upon, or there's something we could market a little bit better, or there's something we can go out and hustle for reviews for. What's kind of next on the list of the validation phase for you?
I typically go through these strategies. I figure out as far as like the demand, competition, all that stuff first. The next stage of validation, that's probably when I do, we'll call it like my due diligence. I want to make sure that this product's not patented, kind of like we spoke about. You can search through it using those methods we talked about to check for seasonality. This would be another one of my due diligence items. Google Trends is a really good resource for this. It's free. Just search Google Trends. You'll find it. You could type in baby towels or marshmallow sticks or whatever. And it'll show you how this product has trended over the seasons and years.
Okay.
So I'm sure if you were to check fidget spinners for this, you'd see a huge spike summer of 2017, and then it's probably dead again. I don't know. Maybe a little bit of demand left. So that'd be part of my due diligence. The next phase really at that point would just be thinking about what types of improvements I can make to this. Maybe it's bundling a small item like a washcloth like we talked about, or maybe it is something else that I discover through reading the bad reviews. This is going to vary quite a bit depending on your particular product and niche. And then after that's when I go out and find factories and start getting prices for this item.
Okay. Do you go through the step of creating a separate email account? I don't know. There's always like, oh, don't use your main email to send messages through Alibaba. You're going to get spammed like crazy. Do you not even worry about that? Or am I just being crazy?
I probably would recommend that. Yeah, I do have a separate email that I use. Okay. And I still get emails from guys that I contacted once 4 years ago about a product that I'm not even interested in selling anymore. So it is kind of nice to keep that separate.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. So that is an actual thing. Okay.
Yeah, that is a good tip.
What is that? Are you ordering samples? Or say, adding a washcloth, not going to need any engineering drawings for that. But if it's a more complex product to say like, hey, can you make this but add a handle on the outside? Or something like, is that, that's kind of intimidating to me. Or is that just like, these guys are good enough at what they do? Like, oh yeah, we can add a handle on that for you, no problem.
Yeah, I would say if it's your improvements, if they're complex enough that they need like engineering drawings, I would recommend to stay away from those.
Okay.
So that's really intimidating to me too. I've never done that. So the improvements that I'd be talking about making would be like my baby towel. So a lot of the bad reviews said the fabric was too thin and they wanted something thicker, more absorbent and warmer. So I didn't have to provide new engineering drawings to ask the factory, like, hey, instead of fabric thickness goes up like GSM grams per square meter. So I was like, hey, instead of 300 GSM, can you just make these same tiles, but with 500 GSM? So that's not something I need to provide engineering drawings for, right? That's something I can just describe through email.
Okay.
Similar thing with my bamboo sticks. My competitors at the time, I think, were all like 18 or 24 inches long. And some of the bad reviews said, hey, like, I wish these were longer. It'd be nicer. My kids have to get too close to the fire. So I did 36 inch long bamboo sticks.
Okay.
So like 3 feet long. So again, I didn't have to provide engineering drawings for that. I was just like, hey, instead of cutting these things 24 inches long, I want 36 inches long sticks. And again, that's something easy for a factory to do just through describing that in an email.
Okay. Okay. And then are you asking for a sample or just say, hey, I'm confident I've done this 100 times. Just ship them.
No, I'll still get it a sample. And this is another, even if you're not validating product quality through getting a sample, which you are, the other really beneficial reason for doing them is it's a way to test this factory a little bit. It's like, okay, how easy are they to work with? How quickly do they ship the sample? What's the communication like? Are they easy to talk to? Do they have good English? So you're kind of figuring all these things out by placing this sample order form.
Okay.
And then it's also a way, like I said, to validate the quality of their product.
Sure, sure. At what point are you going through the branding exercise of saying, okay, now I've got to make my own labels, my own packaging for this stuff, and trying to come up with a brand name like Jungle Sticks?
I would do that after I've ordered the sample. So if we talk about some different items and how long everything takes, the product research phase is going to take some time. Finding the factory is going to take some time because you'll contact like 20 of them and only one or two of those will be good.
Okay.
And then it typically takes like a week or two or maybe 3 weeks to get your sample. So during that time is when you can be thinking about those types of things. What should I call this? Do I need to get a logo made? Do I print my logo on this item or just on the packaging? While you're waiting for that sample is a great time that you have a few weeks to figure all that type of stuff out.
I'm curious on the factory front. So, you know, still kind of starting our search at Alibaba.com, but out of these 20 that you're contacting, what's separating the good from the bad? Is it just communication, price? What kind of criteria are you using there?
Yeah, so it's kind of all of the above. I was really shocked to figure this out for the first time, but for whatever reason, like half of the factories just won't respond to you. Maybe they recognize that you're a relatively small client and it's not like a good client for their particular factory, or for whatever reason, maybe they're just illegitimate. I don't know. So if I contact 20 factories, I'll maybe get 10 responses. Of those 10, probably only 5 will even have answered the questions that I asked them. The rest, it seems, are just like canned responses.
Okay.
So now I'm down to like 5 out of 20. So then I start asking for pricing. I ask to see whether they're able to make these product modifications or improvements. I ask how quickly they can ship a sample, all these types of things. And then I'll typically find that there's like a few winners out of that group.
Okay.
A few of the sales reps are really easy to work with. Their pricing's very competitive. They can make the improvements, all those types of things. And it's like, okay, there's typically a few clear winners based off just communication and willingness to kind of work and cooperate with you.
Did you ever get to the end of that email back and forth? And then they're like, well, our minimum order quantity is like 10,000 units or something, like something just way above your price range.
So I actually typically put that in my first outreach email to them. So my first outreach email to them, it'll be introducing myself, telling them what I'm looking for and how many units I'd like to order, any improvements that I would want to make. And then I typically ask for price and time frame to ship the product. So my first initial email to them has those 5 questions. And again, right away, some people are very organized and communicate well, and they'll answer all 5 questions in the same format that I asked them. And that would be like a good example of like who you'd want to work with, right? Other people will respond back and just answer one of your questions or none of them or whatever. And that's a good indicator that you would not want to work with them. But right away, they would see how many units I'm looking to order. And that way, right off the bat, they would know whether this is a good fit. Because kind of same thing, I didn't really realize this. Like I went to China and visited a bunch of these factories, but some of these factories you go to are just huge, right? The production line has like 200 people working on it. And they're just like pumping out units like crazy. And their customers are typically going to be like Walmart or Home Depot or whoever else, right? So these factories wouldn't be able to create a production run of 1,000 units because it just doesn't make sense. Their production line would be able to do that in an hour, and they're not going to like switch up what they're making for like 1 hour worth of work through their production line, right? But then you go to other factories and there's like a dozen people working there. And you can tell it's just much more a mom and pop operation, or they'd be much more willing to work with smaller clients. They can do small order quantities of 200 units or 500 units or whatever else. And these would be the type of factories that would match up well with private label sellers, because they would like to get another order for 1,000 units, right? They would like to add another small client to their client list. So a lot of it's about having a good fit with the factory that you're working with. You don't want them too small or too big. You want them to be just right for your size as a client.
Okay. And going back to that kind of initial, hey, we want to sell something that's minimum of $18. Let's call it 20 for the sake of round numbers. Is there a maximum price you'd be willing to pay for that product to make sure you got enough margin?
You would have to do the math a little bit. A rule of thumb, Amazon's going to take about 1/3 of the price in fees. That's rule of thumb. You need to figure it out for sure. And they have Amazon has an FBA fee calculator, so you can know for sure.
Okay.
But let's just say they take a third. I like to have 100% return on investment. So if I purchase a product, if I'm purchasing one widget from China for $5, I like to make $5 profit on that. So $20 for round numbers, Amazon's going to take about $7 in fees, give or take. I want 100% ROI on my investment. So that means I'd probably be looking at buying this product for about $6.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. No, thank you for sharing that. Just wanted to make sure. And then that factors into your initial order size and all this stuff. So it's just kind of something to keep in mind.
Yeah. So that's good to keep in mind. And if you want to kind of take it to the next level of accuracy, then you need to be thinking about, okay, how much is it going to cost to ship this product from China to the US? You can factor in how much you think you're going to spend on PPC or to get your photography done. You can kind of be thinking about little expenses like that. And you want to make sure to add all those in and that you still have a good margin.
Is the pay-per-click ads, the PPC ads, what's driving your initial reviews? Or, you know, since you're not allowed to kind of blast out all these free units in exchange for reviews anymore, how do you play that catch-up game?
My launch strategy is essentially twofold. So when you launch a brand new product on Amazon, it's lost on like page 1,000, right? No one can find it.
Yeah.
It's just lost in the depths of Amazon. In order to get your product, I guess at the end of the day, what we're all after is for our product to be organically ranked well for our primary keywords, right? So if we think about it that way, okay, well, what does Amazon use to rank listings? Well, keyword relevancy is important. Okay, so we'll make sure we have all of our good keywords in there. Sales velocity is important. So that's how many units per week or per month is this listing selling? So that's important. And then conversion rate on your listing is very important. So it's like, okay, so we have good keywords in there. That means we need sales velocity, which is hard to do when your product's lost on page 1,000. And we need our listing to convert well. Well, in order to convert well, we can make a very high quality listing and we can offer it at a competitive price. So good images, all those things we talked about earlier, and offering at a competitive price. So maybe when I start out, I decrease the price a little bit to make it a little bit more attractive. The third thing though, is we need sales velocity. So I say, okay, how do we get initial sales when our product's lost on page 1,000? So I do it two ways. I increase my PPC spend. So I'll bid very aggressively on the keywords that are relevant for my product. Maybe on a normal day, my max bid would only be $1, but I'm going to put like $2 or $3 max bid just for those first few weeks so I can get some initial sales. And then I also give out coupons for my product. So back in the day, people would often exchange coupons for reviews, and that is definitely not allowed anymore. But you can still give out coupons for your product, and it's still a tremendous way to gain initial sales and increase that initial sales velocity. So I spend a lot on PPC and I'll give out maybe like 50 coupons over the course of the first 2 weeks so that I have extra 3, 4, 5, 6 sales per day of people redeeming those coupons. And then through those sales, regardless whether they used a coupon or bought your product through a PPC ad or just found it organically, a certain percentage of all those customers will leave reviews.
Gotcha. Okay. So you can start to get the wheel spinning that way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's pretty much the only way. I mean, you need to be thinking about from the beginning, how do I get initial sales? Because you need initial sales to get ranked organically.
Do you see the factories in China starting to compete? I mean, they see all these folks ordering this stuff and they got to know what's happening with it. Do you see them entering the market themselves? Like, I don't know, what do you see like as the kind of risks going forward or mistakes or pitfalls? I don't know, just what maybe dark clouds are ahead in the FBA world?
I'd say I do start to see, I think, more of the factories listing directly on Amazon. That being said, though, if we're just generalizing all of them, they still, I think a lot of them have very poor quality listings.
Sure.
So I guess right now, the competitive advantage that maybe someone listening to this podcast has is you're probably a better copywriter than maybe someone who doesn't speak English as their native language. You'll probably invest more in creating these really high quality images. Just by listening to this, I can tell someone that's listening to this podcast is probably very entrepreneurial minded and very crafty and scrappy to figure out all these little tips and tricks on Amazon. So I'd say the majority of private label sellers still have this competitive edge just because they market the products a lot better. So I'm not too concerned about that right now. I don't know of a lot of pitfalls moving forward with any opportunity in the entrepreneurial space. There is eventually some type of consolidation where the people who have devoted time and resources becoming very excellent at their craft will excel, and people who essentially don't probably will have a harder time competing. That is going to happen at some point on Amazon as well, but it's kind of like you have to at some point choose something, become great at it so you can compete at it.
Or even the Amazon Basics brand, or like, I mean, they've got even dozens of private label brands that you probably wouldn't even recognize the name of. Like, are you seeing those pop up on any of your listings or any of your customers' listings?
So it's funny, you know, Amazon does, so they have their own private labels called Amazon Basics, and they also have like four other private labels, right? If we look at how many products they have, it's only a few hundred. So when we think about, okay, there's a 500 million products on Amazon, or it's like 400 or 500 million. So yeah, about a 500 million. Well, yeah, Amazon's launching their own private label products, but it's only 100 out of a 500 million. So it's like they've just made such a small dent. I think it's really hard for us as sellers and just entrepreneurs to like try to grasp like how big Amazon really is. Well, it doesn't matter if Amazon Basics is launching products. There's so many products and so much demand and volume that goes through Amazon. There's still just a vast number of opportunities for us.
Yeah. Do you see, with Jungle Scout being as popular as it is, kind of becoming the de facto product research tool, do you see customers stepping on themselves? Like, if they're using the same filtering algorithms, they're like, they're coming up with the same results. Is the success of the product becoming a hindrance?
I don't think so. And I think for the same reason that I kind of spoke about earlier, that there's just so much opportunity out there. There's so many niches to go into. And I think the biggest hindrance that we all have as sellers is how much cash we have to invest in inventory. So Jungle Scout has a whole bunch of customers now. But even if we look at all of our customers as a whole and that there's tens of thousands of goods opportunities, it's like, well, it just requires like so much cash to be able to purchase the inventory for all of those opportunities that I think that's still the biggest hindrance. It's not so much how many people are in it.
Yeah, a big upfront investment required to get started, especially compared with freelancing or blogging or something like that. Is there a typical minimum investment? It's like if somebody's brand new to this, they're like, hey, this sounds awesome. What's a realistic number to get into the game?
I'd say if you don't have $2,000 to spend, I would probably recommend either doing retail arbitrage or a lot of the other side hustles that you talk about in your podcast to kind of like save up that amount of money. There's lots of people, you know, I have lots of success stories about how people got started for like $200 or $500. But in my opinion, if I didn't have $2,000 to spend, I would probably be looking at other ways to make money right now.
Going to build up that bankroll a little bit and then jump on in. Greg, thanks for joining me again. This is great stuff. Again, junglescout.com is Greg's site, junglescout.com/SHN. We'll get you a little discount on the Jungle Scout software if you want to check it out. Let's wrap this thing up with your number one tip for Side Hustle Nation.
All right. My number one tip for Side Hustle Nation. This is a new type of mindset that I have, but it's using other people. It's funny because we talked about how much money you need. Using other people's money to help grow your businesses. I feel like as a young entrepreneur, I was very risk averse and I was always taught that like credit cards or investments was like this very bad thing. And it can be if not used properly, but my one tip, and I've started to do this more lately, is using other people's money to help grow my business. So if you're just starting out on Amazon, I would definitely not encourage you to do this. But once like you figure out how the system works, and the only thing hindering your growth is the capital you needed to invest in inventory, Then at that point, I would start looking at ways to use other people's money to purchase inventory to help grow your business. So that's my one little tip, and probably something a little different than most people say.
Absolutely. That's a new one for us. So trying to leverage other people's money, help you grow a little bit faster there. Greg, thanks again. We'll catch up with you soon.
Thanks, Nick. Take care.
This edition of The Side Hustle Show is brought to you by FreshBooks.com, the cloud accounting solution that's recommended by 97% of small business owners. I was chatting with Rob Eng, who's actually a senior marketing manager at FreshBooks, about a new feature they're rolling out called Proposals to help you win more jobs.
We found that our estimates is a great feature when you kind of know what the job is, but we wanted to help business owners win more jobs, and that's through Proposals. So we're pretty excited because what that is really an expanded estimate that allows you to add content, images, you can show what value that you can provide to your client upfront, and which includes maybe attachments of your work, if you're a designer as an example, testimonials from other customers. You could even outline, you know, how you want to proceed with that project. And what's great is it's all integrated within FreshBooks. So when you do win that job, you can easily convert that into an estimate and you could have them pay upfront or a deposit and have it all synced in. So it's all within one system to make things a lot easier for you.
Visit FreshBooks.com/sidehustle to start your 30-day completely free trial today. That's FreshBooks.com/sidehustle for bookkeeping bliss and rockstar support. Okay, so to recap, the three strategies we talked about were, number one, big demand and bad reviews. Number two was big demand, big sales, but poor marketing or poor listings. And the third one was new markets or immature listings. These are listings or products that are selling a lot, but don't have a ton of reviews yet. So my top takeaways from this chat with Greg, number one is go where there's proven demand. That's the common factor in all three of these strategies, is a healthy sales volume. And again, this is something that you can estimate based on the sales rank of each item. You can plug it into the free estimator tool at junglescout.com/estimator, and it'll guess with a pretty fair degree of accuracy how many units that product is selling each month. Because you don't necessarily want to come in with a product that's completely new and groundbreaking, because it's unknown whether there's really a market for that. Kind of reminds me of the self-publishing conversation we had with Derek Murphy in episode 224, where he explained that he was writing books in genres that already had a ton of readers, not trying to create a totally new genre, which brings me to takeaway number two, because then it's on you to put on your marketing hat, thinking about the product improvements you can make, the improvements to the presentation, to the listing that you can make, because if the demand is there, now it's on you to drive those initial sales, those initial reviews, which in theory then translate into sustained and profitable sales going forward. So takeaway number one, go where there's proven demand. Number two was put on your marketing hat. Takeaway number three is to mind the margin and cash flow. This is not a zero cost business to start. Like Greg said, hey, minimum $2,000 likely. And anytime you're selling physical products, you've got to be mindful of your cost of goods sold and your profit margins. And the other thing to consider, and Greg kind of alluded to this at the end, is when you find a product that hits, you're making great money on paper, but you're likely plowing a lot of that capital, maybe even all that capital, back into more inventory to kind of keep feeding the machine. It could be a while before you've got a self-sustaining system. You can kind of take some cash off the table. It's a good problem to have, but just something to be aware of. So mind the margin and the cash flow on this stuff. Once again, sidehustlenation.com/Greg. That's G-R-E-G, just Greg with one G, is where you can find the show notes and links for this episode. And while you're there, be sure to download the free PDF highlight reel with all of Greg's top tips from this conversation. That's it for me. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for an excellent 2017 of Side Hustle Nation. I love you guys, and you inspire me each and every week with your heart and your hustle, and I can't wait to keep serving you as best I can in the months and hopefully years to come. I hope you continue to find value in the show, in the free Facebook community at sidehustlenation.com/FB, and of course, the blog and email list as well. If you haven't already, I hope you'll hit the subscribe button in your podcast player app, because there's lots of great stuff coming up and you don't want to miss it. Until next time, let's go out there and make something happen. And I'll catch you in the next edition of The Side Hustle Show, where you'll meet the woman who says she basically teaches people how to put on their clothes in the morning and earns $100,000 every time she runs a free Facebook challenge. It's a good one. I'll see you then. Hustle on.
Thanks for listening to The Side Hustle Show at www.sidehustlenation.com.
As a Side Hustle Show listener, I know you're driven. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. But I also know you can end up hustling and driving yourself into exhaustion, overwhelm, and even burnout if you don't stay anchored to why you're doing it. That's why I want to recommend another podcast that will massively support your side hustle. It's called What Drives You with host Kevin Miller. Kevin's a former pro athlete. He's a lifelong entrepreneur who started 19 different businesses. He's a father of 9 kids, an author, and a mountain adventurer as well. He knows both the glory and the dark side of drive and has devoted his life to helping people who want to drive further, faster, but also enjoy the ride every single day. He brings on today's most influential people in personal and business development to see what drives them and get their guidance on the key ingredients that power our own drive. If you want to fully harness your drive and find peace and fulfillment in the process, go find What Drives You with Kevin Miller wherever you listen to podcasts.